setting and a real gift of the natural world. That becomes part of our practice and mirrors for us the rhythms of life within us, the rhythms of life surrounding us. We begin to feel or deepen in our sense in a situation like this, in a setting and in a retreat situation, a sense of connection in this village we're co-creating, spiritual village, a sense of connection which is really the opening of the heart, the connection of the heart. And I'm sure that most everyone in this room has had moments of probably an unexpected, unsuspected moment of this connection of the heart. Moments of immediate presence, moments of just being. It's a kind of spiritual attention, we could call it. It's a moment when our heart opens and eases, relaxes in the midst of any moment of life. It might be a moment in nature, a still moment, early morning, the sound of a bird, the connection with a beautiful flower, or the passing of another human being on the path. And there's just that moment of feeling really connected. Absolutely present. It's as though in that moment we fall through ourselves, our usual selves, into this intuitive place of what we could call the essence of things. And our heart opens. Our heart and mind open, receptive, radically receptive to just what is in that moment. There's a very deep connection, and it's what we call love. We call this connection love very often. We touch this wonder, really. Boundlessness, wonder, this essential radiance of light in that moment of connection, in that moment of unconditional connectedness, what we could call love. And so maybe for just that moment we dissolve out of our separateness, our seeming separateness. And with this heart connection, this boundless heart, we just simply be in love, we could say. An unconditional moment in love. So the world around us here, the peopled world, the natural world and the world within us are reflecting and offering, constantly offering us this possibility. Beyond our self, connected in unconditional love, friendship. This is a piece from a great yogi named Albert Einstein. A human being is part of the whole, called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He or she experiences himself, her thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his or her consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of love and compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. So this is our possibility. This place, many of you have been here before, and it's a place that of course nurtures and feeds this possibility. All of the accumulated energy over years of all the people that have come here to practice, to look in, to connect, to understand. All the teachers that have come to offer teachings towards this possibility. It's an ongoing circular relationship. We partake of that and we offer to it, increasing it, adding to it. So a great gift to be here for all of us. Alone and together. A place where we're well taken care of. Wonderful food, simple surroundings, life pared down to, for most people, what is a much simpler life, less complex. Many less activities, many less demands. And potentially many less seeming needs. And very little to do, actually, which is a good reminder for those that have been here and those that are just beginning that there's really very little to do. Many of you, I'm sure, have quite a strong habit of keeping very busy. And we have such a habit sometimes that when there's not a lot of busyness to engage in, we might try to create all sorts of things to keep ourselves busy out of habit. Even in a place like this, that's possible. But I highly encourage you not to do that. If you find yourself inclining towards that, just stop and start again, being not busy. Take a breath or two. There's a kind of letting go in this time of not being busy, a time of renunciation, a kind of letting go, renunciation. Letting go of the busyness, letting go of the usual distractions that we use to engage in to try to relax out of all of the busyness. Often, it's just another form of busyness, keeping it going. So really a great gift, renunciation, simplifying, letting go. In a retreat, in a place like this, we really have this possibility of simply being. We really don't have to be anybody at all, anybody special at all. Nobody in particular. We don't have to be anybody in particular. We don't have to become anybody in particular or anything in particular. We just have this possibility of being, simply being. What an incredible potential. How fortunate. What a relief not to have to be somebody. And so we begin. We begin again in this sanctuary, in this place of safety, this place of protection, this place where there is the energy of deep respect, acceptance for what we're doing. It's a great gift that you've given yourself, and certainly a great gift that you give each other in being here together. This gift is really the beginning of the practice of metta, the cultivation of the heart of friendship, unconditional kindness, care, love. The friendship you offer yourself in bringing yourself to a situation like this, a practice period like this, and the gift you give to others, the friendship of your presence with practice. The beginning of metta practice together here. Another gift that I'll speak about just briefly, another aspect of the retreat that is a gift, is the silence. Most of you are familiar with at least short periods of silence in retreat. The silence is really the container that allows the practice to unfold. It holds us in itself. Silence is a wonderful thing. It doesn't expect anything. Silence. It doesn't judge. It's infinitely patient. Silence is boundlessly, spaciously open and totally accepting, allowing. This silence that everything emerges out of and returns to. Sometimes, as we partake of the silence, as we connect with it, as we begin to live with it and in it, it sometimes feels like as though the windows of the world, the windows of the universe, have just been thrown wide open. This boundlessness of silence. maybe like we might feel early in the morning, we go outside after it's been raining, this kind of freshness, openness, this silence that is alive. It's very alive. In a sense, the energy of silence is, it kind of, at the same time that it's peaceful, it charges the atmosphere with a kind of live energy. I mentioned this in the first half, that the Thais, I'm told, have quite a number of words for silence to describe it, to describe its qualities, because it's so alive. It's not a dead thing. It has energy in it. Holy silence, it's sometimes called, or noble silence, offering us the possibility to really begin to find our deepest, truest self, where there's the possibility of, for the boundless capacity of our heart to be known, this boundless potential, this boundless capacity of our heart to be directly experienced. And so we're opening in this practice to deep intimacy, the deepest intimacy possible. This intimacy with ourself, this connection of the heart with ourself and with all forms of life as it expands, as it grows. There are a couple of basic supports for practice that the Buddha offered that are still quite relevant in this moment. As we co-create this practice village, this spiritual village, this container for our metta practice, this practice of friendship, of loving kindness, the Buddha offered some guidelines, what are formally called precepts. They're still very relevant today, as they were 2,500 years ago. And they really are the ground, the very ground of metta practice, of the practice of the heart. They're based in non-harming. Each of these guidelines, these precepts, are based with the intention to not harm, non-harming. And one of the wonderful things about these guidelines is that they are points of practice. They're aspects of our exploration into the nature of the heart. Our relationship to any one of these guidelines might light up at any moment in the next days as a point of practice for us, bringing our attention right into the moment and into the process of this development of the capacity of our heart. So they're really an important ground, an essential ground of practice. As we deepen into living with a greater sensitivity, respect, honor, care for life, which is what these guidelines direct us towards, a greater ease of well-being begins to develop within us. We begin to relax. The heart relaxes. And we don't spend so much time worrying about things, trying to hide anything or trying to cover up anything or trying to make up for something. We don't spend time pretending anything, either to ourselves or to anyone else. Our heart is freed up, much more at ease. And in the context of retreat, there's much more time, much more energy available for our practice to deepen, to grow, to expand, to experience ourselves, to begin to truly, really know ourselves as an interconnected being with all other living beings. I'd like to read a version of the, I think you have a translated version, maybe in English and translation, I don't know, of the formal guidelines, the formal precepts, five precepts that are the ones that are usually used for lay practitioners. In the morning at the 8:30 sitting, we'll chant those each morning together, not in English and not in Hebrew, but in Pali, because I feel like it really sets a beautiful tone for the practice. But this evening I'd like to read a version of these guidelines that was written by a woman named Stephanie Kaza. And it's a somewhat poetic version, and it really touches the essence of this practice in relationship to the guidelines. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow not to kill. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not take what is not given. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not engage in abusive relationships. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not speak falsely or deceptively. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not harm self or other through poisonous thought or substance. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not dwell on past errors. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not speak of self separate from others. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not possess any thing or form of life selfishly. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not harbor ill will toward any plant, animal, or human being. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not abuse the great truth of the three treasures. And the three treasures, or the three jewels, or the refuges, as they're formally called. The first is the Buddha, which for many people, it's the historical Buddha who's offered these teachings. It also is our true nature, our Buddha nature, taking refuge in that, and the faith that that is so, and the possibility that we'll know that. The second treasure or jewel is the Dharma, which is the teachings, the way of the truth. And looking at it in a fuller way, a deeper and fuller way, when we take refuge in the Dharma, we take refuge in everything. Everything. From the perspective that everything, every phenomena, every experience has the potential to reveal the truth of our heart, the truth of our mind. So taking refuge in the Dharma is the way of truth. And the Sangha, the last jewel or the last treasure. Historically, it's the monastic Sangha, the monks and the nuns, from the time of the Buddha up until this very moment and ongoing beyond this moment. And it's also the community. The word Sangha translates as community. It's this community right here, and all the community of lay practitioners over the centuries that have gone before us and that will go on after us. So taking refuge in each other, in a sense, this community, this support, this relationship of practitioners. The Buddha talked about the practice of these guidelines, these precepts. Sila is the Pali word, practicing what is often translated as morality, which basically comes down to the practice of caring, the practice of connectedness, the practice of the manifestation of the heart of loving kindness and compassion. So, metta. Metta is one of four Brahma-viharas. Brahma-vihara, the words Brahma-vihara, translating as divine abidings. Sometimes they're called the immeasurables, these qualities, these capacities, these energies, the immeasurables. Metta being the first. And in Pali, the root word metta in Pali translates as friendship. Unconditional friendship, unconditional loving kindness. This is a poem that was written over 1,000 years ago. Or not quite, actually, but close to that. By a Buddhist nun. And it's called Metta. If you develop love truly great, rid of the desire to hold and possess, that strong, clear love, untainted by lust, that love which does not expect to be repaid, that love which is firm but not grasping, enduring, but not tied down, gentle, settled, diamond hard, but not hurting, helpful, but not interfering, cool and refreshing, giving more than taking, dignified, but not proud, soft, but not weak. That love which leads to enlightenment, then you will be washed of all ill will. In the Chinese written language, the character, the written character for love was developed from two ancient pictographs, one on top of the other, or one below the other, depending how you look at it. The top symbol was a very simple pictograph representing a person breathing, the symbol of breath, or breath happening. And the bottom symbol was one for the heart. So the Chinese pictographic writing for love is breath through the heart, or breathing through the heart. And this is the derivation of today's Chinese writing. It doesn't really look quite like that today. Breath through the heart. So as we practice loving kindness, as we practice metta, we're practicing opening the heart. We're practicing the expansion of the heart, like the air that moves through us as we breathe, as breath happens. And we really can develop a love that is truly great, a love that is really boundless, that's not limited, that's not a finite thing, but very infinite. Spacious, a boundless heart. The Brahmaviharas, these immeasurables, the divine abidings, metta, loving kindness, unconditional friendship. I'm going to give you the Pali words. Karuna, which is boundless compassion, great compassion. Mudita, which is appreciative joy or empathetic joy. Joy in relation to others' happinesses, others' happiness, others' successes. And also in relation to our own happiness, our own success. Mudita, joy. And the last of the four is upekkha, equanimity. The cooling balance of heart, of mind. They're perfectly natural, absolutely natural aspects of our humanness. Perfectly natural, and in that sense, ordinary. And at the same time, extraordinary. Extraordinary capacities of being. Extraordinary natural capacities of being. As these capacities, as these facets of being deepen, as they expand, and at some point mature, these qualities or these capacities are those of a Buddha being, maturing into the limitless, boundless capacity of the liberated heart, liberated mind. At any moment. And maybe sustaining just for the duration of the snap of a finger. Any one of us can experience the purity of metta, the heart's release, the liberation of the heart. Shakyamuni Buddha talked about this as making one a truly spiritual being. This retreat will be focusing primarily on metta, unconditional friendship, loving kindness. It's been called the most subtle and the most powerful energy in the universe. It's said that during the time of the Buddha, there were a rather large group of monks, as the story goes, about 500 monks, practicing very deep in the forest. They were practicing vipassana, wisdom practice. And they found themselves at one point becoming quite afraid, quite fearful. Fearful of all of the unseen energies in the forest. They felt threatened. They felt afraid. But they didn't, and so afraid, enough of them, that they felt like they couldn't practice, they couldn't concentrate. Became impossible to concentrate because they were so caught in their fear. So they went to the Buddha, and they asked him what to do, or could they go somewhere else, or what's the best approach here. And the Buddha said, you have to stay where you are. That's the best place to practice. But I'll give you a teaching and some practices, a tool that will lessen or alleviate your fear so that you can practice the vipassana practice. And so he spoke the metta sutta, the metta teaching, and gave them the metta practice. And it said that they went back to their forest retreat and they very diligently practiced metta for a while. And not only did their fear subside, but they became had the experience of connection with the seen and unseen energies in the forest that were so frightening before this. And it's also said in the teachings that that the unseen energies, the devas living in the forest, were around during this practice, and they were so taken by it and felt the connection that they too started practicing metta. And this is from Krishnamurti, from his meditation journal. When the heart enters into the mind, the mind has quite a different quality. It is really then limitless. A sense of living in a vast space where you are part of everything. Meditation is the movement of love. It isn't the love of the one or of the many. It's like water that anyone can drink out of any jar, whether golden or earthenware. It's inexhaustible. It's as though the mind enters into itself, or the heart enters into itself, beginning at the surface and penetrating ever more deeply until depth and height have lost their meaning and every form of measurement ceases. In this state, there's complete peace. Not the contentment which one has, which comes through gratification, but a peace that has order, beauty, and intensity. It can all be destroyed, as you can destroy a flower. But yet, because of its very vulnerability, it's indestructible. Metta, this immeasurable capacity, immeasurable impartiality, embracing impartially all sentient beings, not only those that we are close to in our lives, or those who are useful to us, or those who are pleasing to us. Immeasurable impartiality, embracing all sentient beings, this possibility. My Burmese teacher, Sayadaw Pandita, said to us a number of times, he said, most people think that everything begins and ends here, and he knocked himself on the head. He said, but I've been checking for a long time. He's in his 70s now, and he was a monk since he was, I think, about 8 years old. He said, I've been checking for a long time, and he said, I found out that everything begins and ends here, and he did this. So, upon checking myself, not for as many years as he did, so it seems, here, begins and ends here. The Buddha talked about how powerful and how consequential it is to experience just one moment of a mind, a heart, fully absorbed in the feeling of metta. A moment when the sense of separation, the sense of distinction, difference, the sense of discrimination has disappeared, is absent, even for just a moment. This can be called love. Metta is really the ground. It's the bed for that all of the other divine abidings spring from. And it's really the ground, the bed, that allows the whole of our practice, including vipassana, to unfold from and into this core of kindness. As we practice in very specific ways, as we'll be doing, towards cultivating, towards prompting loving kindness, friendship, unconditional friendship, and as it develops, as it grows itself, we could say, it grows itself. We don't grow it. We create the conditions for it to grow. There's a very natural unfolding and a ripening of patience, of confidence, of fearlessness, trust, happiness, through this process of our practice, a very natural opening and ripening of the heart. The various flavors, we could say, of ill will, hostility, judgment, hatred, dislike, towards ourselves or towards others, begins to subside. This practice, the development of metta, weakens these states. It's sometimes spoken of as metta secluding or cloistering the heart, the mind, from fear, from anger, cloistering, protecting. These strong energies that move through our mind, through our body, through our heart, begin to weaken, they begin to fade under the very strong light of a loving heart. The more moments of metta, the less moments of anger, worry, anxiety, fear. And that's a very important point. The more moments of metta, the less moments of anger, worry, anxiety, fear. It's not possible to feel unconditional friendship, love, and fear simultaneously. We actually only feel one thing at a time, even though sometimes it goes very, very, very fast. But it's just this, just this, just this. So as we cultivate this heart of loving kindness and we have more moments of friendship, it takes up the space, so to say. There are less moments of anger, fear, jealousy, worry, anxiety. All those strong energies, difficult energies, can't exist in the same moment as metta. Someone once asked Nisargadatta Maharaj, what can make me love? And his answer was, you are love when you're not afraid. You are love when you're not afraid. I think that every one of us essentially wants to be a loving person. We really want to be able to truly love. I think that's how we are. It's what we want. We want to be able to truly love. And we've had moments of that. And we know that when we're in that state, or in this state, of love, true, pure love, there's this sense of not needing anything else, or not needing anything. There's no need in that moment. In that. So we begin the practice of metta with ourself. Practicing loving kindness for ourselves, practicing loving kindness for others, it's characterized by wishing well. By wishing well for ourselves and wishing well for others in as clear and unhampered a way as possible. At any given time. Our conventional relative notions of love, they imply or connote a kind of a possessiveness, a conditionality. If you do, if you are, if you stay, I'll love you. If this situation remains, I'll love you. Conditions, lots of conditions. In the teachings, metta is compared to a mother's love for her only child. And in the words of the Buddha, even as a mother unconditionally protects with her life her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. And so we begin with ourselves. when I was a child, many times my mother would tell me, if you can't really love yourself, truly love yourself, you can't love another. As a child, I had no idea what she was, what that meant. But she said it a lot of times. I never forgot it. And I've been learning over the years what that means. She is a wise woman. I appreciate that teaching very much. This is from the Buddha. I visited all quarters with my mind, nor found I any dearer than myself. Self is likewise to every other dear. Who loves herself or himself will never harm another. No matter where we look, anywhere, you'll actually never find another being, either more or less deserving of your love and your care than yourself. We are as deserving of our care, of our love, as every other being is. No more, no less. And that's not selfish. That's natural. Natural. The intimacy of this depth of self-acceptance, as it unfolds through our practice, it becomes an essential and expanding intimacy, a very deep intimacy with all sentient life. The intimacy of connection, the intimacy of interconnection, the essential intimacy of non-separateness with all beings. We come to know very directly, very experientially, the truth of a radical, expansive, boundless intimacy and acceptance of life in all forms, all of its forms, which very much includes ourself. So from this perspective, knowing the interrelatedness of all beings, knowing that, knowing the interrelatedness of all things is metta. That is metta. That is unconditional friendship, love. And it's an antidote, a remedy to the loneliness, the existential loneliness that so often is the disease in our time. The specific practice of metta is done by silently repeating phrases. Some of you know this, many of you probably. Silently repeating phrases over and over and over again to oneself. And beginning with ourself, to oneself, for oneself, by oneself. It's as though we're showering ourself. We're saturating ourselves with this unconditional friendship, this unconditional love. At one point, when I was doing an extended period of metta practice, it was a visceral feeling almost for me, as though I was washing myself, showering myself with unconditional friendship, outwardly and inwardly. A very important key in the practice is patience. The Buddha talked a lot about patience in many different ways. And one of the things he said was that there's no higher rule than patience. There's no nirvana, no freedom higher than forbearance. No greater thing exists than patience, he said at one point. in speaking of it this way, forbearance, bearing forbearance, it's not meant as a quality of kind of a tight or grim endurance. It's not this way of putting up with it until it's over or toughing it out. That's not what he means at all by patience. It's about the quality of softness, the quality of acceptance, receptivity, patience in this flavor, forbearance in this sense, softness, receptivity, acceptance. It's the approach. It's what allows us to approach, to be open, to be fully present, to practice. And it's very important. The practice of metta is really quite a powerful way to introduce the heart, to introduce the mind to these qualities of patience, a very clear way towards cultivating a patient, loving heart, and really beginning to come to know that in a very deep experiential way, that this is an advantage, that these qualities are an advantage, that this is a great benefit in our life, for our life. And so we begin our metta practice with ourself, with our moods, whatever our moods are, with our difficult feelings in mind, in body, in heart, with our beautiful feelings of mind, of body, of heart, and not demanding that they not be here. Emotions, sensations, feelings just naturally arise and naturally go away. Struggling with them, fighting with them, trying to get rid of them actually perpetuates them. We get stuck in them, trying to push them away. I sometimes think of that stuck place as like Velcro practice. With a close friend, you're frowning. Velcro's, you know, that sticky stuff. Sticks to itself. We stick to them if we fight with them. With a close friend, a dear friend, we don't usually demand that they stop feeling what they're feeling, especially if they're being very honest with us and sharing their feelings. We treat our dear friends kindly. We listen to them. We treat them with care. Can we also do this for ourselves? Metta arises, loving kindness, friendship arises, when we begin to accept all the different beings, both within ourself and outside of ourself, rather than trying to manipulate or ignore these beings. Unconditional love is really a deep understanding. Understanding, wisdom, is unconditional love. I'd like to close the talk with a little piece from a book called The Education of Little Tree. It's written by, it's the story of a young Native American boy. And he lived with his grandparents. He had a very wise grandmother. Grandma said, everybody has two minds. One mind has to do with the necessaries of body living. First, let me just say, it's written in a kind of speech, English, of course, but that has a speech of the area, speech of the particular part of the country that it comes from. So I'm reading. I won't pronounce it with the accent. It's kind of a southern accent, but just some of the words and the way it's expressed is not the way I usually talk. Grandma said everybody has two minds. One of the minds has to do with the necessaries for body living. You had to use it to figure out how to get shelter and eating and such like for the body. She said you had to use it to mate and have young uns and such, young ones. She said we have to have that mind so as we can carry on. But she said we had another mind that had nothing to do at all with such. She said it was the spirit mind. Grandma said if you use the body living mind to think greedy or mean, if you was always cutting at folks with it and figuring how to profit material from them, then you would shrink up your spirit mind to a size no bigger than a hickory nut. Hickory nuts, I don't know, they're tiny. Grandma said that when your body died, the body living mind died with it. And if that's the way you'd thought all your life, there you was, stuck with a hickory nut spirit. As the spirit mind was all that lived when everything else died. In Buddhism, it's not called the spirit, but it's the energy that is left, that keeps going. Then Grandma said, when you was born back, and you was bound to be, then there you was, born with a hickory nut spirit mind that had practically no understanding of anything. Then it might shrink up to the size of a pea and could disappear if the body living mind took over total. In such case, you lost your spirit completely. That's how you become dead people, Grandma said. She said you could easy spot dead people. She said dead people, when they looked at a woman, saw nothing but dirty. When they looked at other people, they saw nothing but bad. When they looked at a tree, they saw nothing but lumber and profit, never beauty. Grandma said there was dead people walking around. Grandma said that the spirit mind was like any other muscle. If you used it, it got bigger, got stronger. She said that the only way it could get that way was by using it to understand. But you couldn't open the door to it until you quit being greedy and such with your body mind. Then understanding commenced to take up, and the more you tried to understand, the bigger it got. Grandma said understanding and love was the same thing, except folks went about it backwards too many times, trying to pretend they loved things when they didn't understand them, which can't be done. I see right out that I was going to commence trying to understand practically everybody, for I sure didn't want to come up with the hickory nut spirit. So from one perspective, this is our practice. We don't want to come up with the hickory nut spirit either. So let's just sit for a moment quietly. Let your body, heart, and mind relax, soften, open. Bringing the attention to the heart center. Just allowing the breath to move gently, softly, through this energy center.